Hey, everybody, this is Eric Mueller, the host of The Eric Mueller Show. You're tuned into the podcast that explores what makes any successful person's inner clock tick by unlocking the most impactful tools within their success portfolio. I'm joined today by Matt Seifeld, the Executive Vice President at MedEvolve, a top provider of data-driven solutions that helps healthcare businesses optimize their revenue cycles and their medical billing teams to lower money collection costs, increase efficiency, and enhance revenues. Let's head on over to the interview. Matt, welcome to the show.
Eric, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
I'm looking forward to this one, Matt. And before we really dive deep into this, really the entrepreneurial story of yours and the background you have and the expertise on healthcare revenue cycles as a whole, we want to know what makes up your success portfolio. So if you're new to this show, a quick background, a way to view this is to think of your investment portfolio, basically that compilation of those financial assets that lays the foundation for financial goals. Well, here on the Eric Mueller Show, I want to discover how successful people like Matt really invest in themselves and build the foundation for their success as a person. So Matt, start us off. What are some skills or traits, habits or mindsets that make up your success portfolio?
Yeah, well, I think you know, the first word that comes to mind for me is discipline. I think, you know, there's a misconception out there where people think it's motivation that drives success, and that's not. I can be highly motivated to lose weight, but am I disciplined in doing what it's going to take between diet and exercise to give myself the best shot at achieving the outcome that I want and I hope for? So I think discipline is the number one thing. The other thing is, and my dad taught this to me years and years ago, is that we control actions, not outcomes in life. I coach a lot of youth sports, and whether it's an 8-year-old baseball player or it's a 17-year-old high school track athlete, I make sure that they understand that you can say you want to achieve this, but there's no guarantee, no matter what you do, you'll ever achieve it. But what you can do is show up, be disciplined, and make sure that your actions are aligned. That's going to give you the best shot at that achievement. You know, it's the old, I want to play professional baseball. That's a great outcome. That would be amazing, wouldn't it be? Now, what are we doing every day, right? How obsessed are we willing to be? And what length are we willing to go to give ourselves the best shot at that? I think the third thing is around obsession. And I know obsession can be like a bad term, you know, like, oh, you're obsessed about something. But I really do believe that in order to be successful in what you want to achieve, right, you have to have the discipline, but you also have to become obsessed with achieving that goal. And as an entrepreneur, I can tell you, I learned this firsthand. You know, I started my career in healthcare consulting. I was flying all over the country, meeting, you know, trying to work on the revenue cycles or the financial side of the healthcare, right? So the service gets delivered. Now we got to get paid for it. So a lot of people, a lot of process, a lot of technology involved in that. Early on in my career, I realized there was a big gap between the financial systems communicating to the insurance companies and back to those healthcare providers on basic information, right? Basic things that you would need to know to make sure that you're not leaving a lot of money on the table. So I left Deloitte in 2006, at the end of 2006, to start my first company, which was Interpoint. And that's what we did, was we basically were filling that gap through workflow automation and analytics. So when you think of like entrepreneurism, and Eric, you and I were talking about this a little bit before the show began, it's not about coming up with the idea that nobody's done. Every once in a while, somebody does do that, right? It's great. Okay.
You really nailed it,
right? It's actually about looking at something that's impacting your life in a negative way, or people around you, or whatever it is, and saying, is there a better way to do these things? You know, and if the answer is yes, then the question is, do you have the discipline and the obsession to take a shot of it? Because there's no guarantee. I mean, I spent 7 years, you know, and it was a recession. It was the Great Recession, right? If any of your listeners remember what the economy looked like in 08, 09, and 2010, it wasn't a good time to start businesses or run businesses, right? And so you had to really, really get creative with how you were going to remain solvent, knowing that the tomorrow you may not be, You know, and it's no different than saying I want to be a pro baseball player and not making it. You know, I didn't make it. Okay. Well, did you learn anything along the way? Absolutely. Did you have fun along the way? Absolutely. Did you experience things in that journey to that outcome that you just didn't get that's going to apply to other areas in your life to make you successful? Absolutely. And so I think that's really, really important for your listeners to understand is that starting companies is it's great. It's great to start a company. But the question is, do you have the discipline and do you have the obsession that it's going to take in the hard times, right? When it's easy, but it's not going to be easy no matter what the idea is.
Yeah. And we also, Matt, we talked pre-interview as well about just athletics and you share a background, you know, honestly in track and field as well. Like myself, you were a thrower and I was a distance runner, but you also had some distance running experience earlier in your life. And so, you know, that discipline piece and how important that is to succeed in those elements of, you know, athletics. Did you find that really the definition of success for you and the way that you view success, did you realize that changed over time for you throughout your career? And maybe athletics shaped that a little bit, but I sometimes think you can put kind of a metric on, are you a successful athlete in some ways by, you know, how high you place, how much, you know, how much you've, you know, won, or, you know, you're able to somewhat tie it to that, but there's also the intangible piece of success where, you know, how much have you grown by simply training for, you know, a race or an event? And it doesn't necessarily matter how you place because you've grown. It kind of relates a little bit to what you just shared about entrepreneurship. But if I were to ask you right now, what is your definition of success? What would you say, Matt?
So for me, actually, it was not so much about what outcome I was going to achieve. It was about how did I compete? And this is something that I train all of my throwers and I coach high school track here in San Diego is I say, you're going to go up against people that may have better technique. They may be, in the case of throws, they may be stronger. They may be a lot stronger. But the question is, the above the neck stuff, the stuff going on between your ears, that can make or break an athlete, right? And so I would get into like the NCAA nationals as a skinnier guy. I mean, I qualified in each year in shot put, discus and hammer. So people assume without seeing me that I would be this huge, you know, guy. I mean, I'm not small, 6'5". I was probably 245, 250 in college, but that was actually weight wise, pretty light for a thrower. But I knew how to compete. I knew how to make sure that I didn't allow noise to distract me. I didn't allow other competition and what they're doing to distract me. It wasn't always that way. I wasn't born with that. That's something that I had to learn and experience the negatives and the positives with to figure it out. But it's really, really important when you start to think about the emotional sobriety. You know, I tell this to my sons is like the only person that can make you feel bad is you. And it's like, wait, what do you mean, Dad? So-and-so said this about me. I said, okay, how did you take that? Did you dismiss it or did you internalize it as truth? It's not truth. It's what they said. You create truth, right? And so learning how to compete in athletics was the most important piece. And it was really the mind. And when we talk a little bit later in the show about sobriety and recovery, I used the same tools to give myself the best chance at becoming sober and maintaining sobriety too, which I know we'll get to. But a lot of people think it's about the trophies. They think it's about the ribbons. They think it's about the fame. Look, those are all awesome things. All awesome things. But I can show you a kid that comes up second place that may be much mentally stronger than the kid that walked into first, right? And especially you see that on team sports a lot too. It's how you battled, it's how you competed. And there's no shame in that. I think when we make it about the outcome first, we lose a lot there. You know, and I see it in youth sports. I'm a lot older than you are, you know, Eric, but I've been coaching these youth sports now for the last 7 or 8 years. You see this, you know, this a 9-year-old who goes to tears because he strikes out, you know, or, you know, it's like, whoa, wait a minute. What, how many at bats are you going to have? First of all, in the majors, if you hit 2.5 out of 10 times, you're making millions of dollars. Like, why are we upset about that? Like the biggest home run hitters strike out the most. Like, so teaching people at a younger age to start to really focus on the mind, control actions, not outcomes, become obsessed with the goals that you say you want to achieve, knowing that you may never achieve them, but man, that journey along the way is going to be pretty special. And it's going to create much more callousness and ability to kind of go after the next thing you want, right? So like starting a company today, I'm going to take a lot of lessons learned and mistakes I made from 2006 to 2011, right? I'll still make more mistakes, but hopefully they won't be quite the same as the ones that I made when I was young, 29-year-old, thinking, hey, let's start a business and see what happens.
Yeah, I think those are all really important pieces to keep in mind. And I particularly resonate with the obsessed piece, because I think I genuinely believe that I have like an obsessive mind. And in some ways, you know, that can be to your own detriment. I mean, you can, you know, get hung up on something that is not productive to your growth. But have you found in, let's chat a little bit about the Interpoint Partners company, the medical software company that you did start during that recession. At what point did you realize that you had that obsessive feeling about that? Or have you always kind of had, you know, somewhat of an obsessive way of thinking about certain things?
I think, like, you know, at 46 now, looking back, even as a child, like, you know, and talking more with my parents about how I was, you know, I'm an identical twin, you know, so I grew up with somebody that looked exactly like me. We did the same sports, right? I was a quarterback, he was a tight end, I was a pitcher, he was a first baseman, right? I mean, we had some divergence, but not much, right? And so I believe that having that kind of in constant competitor, you know, in my space, it definitely helped me a little bit achieve some of these things. But look, with Interpoint, I got to the point in my career, and I was only 6 years in, where I saw this inefficiency with just getting access to intelligent information. Is that most businesses are run nowadays, right, where you actually can understand the problems and what to do about it in near real time. Healthcare can't do that. Healthcare still to this day is so archaic with the way in which they run their businesses, which is why you keep seeing failures time and time again, right? And so for me, that obsession was really around trying to develop a solution that would make me way more efficient as a consultant and help my clients better. And that's what was really the start of that company. And I've actually carried that methodology forward. I mean, at MedEvolve here, when I came on in 2017, I saw a big gap in what their billing software platform. And guess what we did, right? The last 5 years, I've recreated Interpoint and put it on steroids, I always say, because we've done a lot more than I was capable of doing 12 years ago, right? Because of new technologies and integrations. But it's the same principles, ironically, just 15 years later, same principle, same problems we're trying to solve in this crazy industry, predicated on actual intelligence, right? And now you've got the people component. People don't want to work. They're working from home, right? They're going to do just enough to not get fired, right? I'm sure, you know, you hear about quiet quitting and acting your wage and all these themes, right? And you know, when I speak at healthcare conferences, most of the people in the audience are thinking that way. They're like, oh, I mean, I'm kind of motivated, not really, you know? And these are folks that are running groups, they're running practices. So it's trying to find ways in which we can motivate people, right? And this kind of ties back into obsession, self-actualization. You know, it kind of ties back into what we started this podcast, which is like, do you want to be an achiever anymore? Right? Not everybody wants to be an achiever. In fact, I'd say it's the minority that want to be achievers. And so what I'm trying to do is say, if 95% of the world doesn't really care about achievement and they're just kind of existing, right? Media gratification, everything's easy to get, AI, blah, blah, blah. Then how do we get that 5% to motivate another 1%, right? It's kind of like sobriety, right? If you have 100 people, this is a fact. If you have 100 people that come to you and say, Eric, I'm ready to get sober, and they start that journey, more than 95% of those people will not make a year.
Wow.
Scary, right? 95% or more. So then the question is there a technology, i.e. what I developed with my LifeLink, that would give me 1% improvement? Because what does 1% improvement do to not only the person afflicted with addiction, but what about the 10 people around them that have suffered along with them that are now experiencing a much more extraordinary life because somebody put down a drink or a drug or emotional maladaptive behavior, right? So it really comes back to looking for ways to become more selfless in the acts that we do in life, right? And then again, as I think about being successful as an entrepreneur, I feel that when people start companies with selflessness in mind, and all the bankers on your podcast and all the finance guys and the Wall Street guys that just care about buying other people's ideas and flipping it for more money, they're not included in this conversation. I'm talking about people that genuinely have a passion about helping others and inspiring others to help others. And that to me starts to become the most powerful business venture because the passion comes through in your voice. People are not looking at you as, well, Eric, you know, you're Harvard MBA and you know, you've been on Wall Street for 10 years. And yeah, tell me more about what you don't think is right about the financials of my business, right? It's your passion about some change. And Interpoint was that way. It's that, you know, even in the worst times at Interpoint, I still believed that we were doing something magnificent. And I still, to this day, even the stuff we've now built, our whole effective intelligence suite, you know, out here at MetaVolve, doing the same thing. Like, I still believe, like, I'm not giving up on healthcare. There are days where I want to, don't get me wrong. I have those days where I'm like, done. Like, why do these physician groups, why do these hospitals continue to not make good decisions? But I'm not giving up, right? I'm not giving up because I do believe that there's a possibility out there for transformation in this industry, right? And that's really what it comes down to. You know, is what we're willing to do. But selflessness is a big theme in my life now, and it wasn't always like that, right? And the last 6 years being in recovery myself, I've really learned that when we wake up with the intent to help others, it's amazing how good things actually happen, right? And it also builds self-esteem, which is something that I struggled with most of my life, you know, identity. Am I good enough? You know, am I better than my brother? Do my parents love me more? Right? Do I look good? Do I feel good? Am I always being good? Right? There's a lot of that to it.
Yeah. And I think, and you and I chatted a little bit about this pre-interview as well, you know, about that sobriety piece. So I think let's jump into that and talk about, you know, this app that you've created, My Lifelink, which basically is a community to connect people that are going through, you know, the phases of addiction and being able to kind of rely on each other to get through that. Is that a pretty accurate way to assess the app? Or I mean, I guess what is the inspiration behind that outside of, you know, yourself, you know, going through the process and realizing, you know, you want to be a resource for people that are also doing that. What really led to you starting that and how has it gone so far?
Yeah. I mean, again, as I've said, I mean, it came out of necessity, right? Is it, you know, the biggest challenge that I see with people getting sober? And we have to be careful too, because, you know, I think historically people think of it's an alcoholic or it's a drug addict, but there's a lot of maladaptive behavioral addictions going on now, especially with technology, you know, and then you start looking at the emotional addictions, right? People that wake up every day addicted to anxiety or not being good enough, right? And so we've really tried to broaden the message of what addiction is, right? When obsession becomes normal, that's addiction. But the biggest issue with people getting in was the stigma. And feeling like they were the only person in this world suffering the way they're suffering. And let me expand on that. Well, it turns out there's actually lots of people in this world just like me that are entrepreneurs, college educated, business executives, fathers, you know, surfers, NCAA athlete. You start building my profile beyond Matt had an alcohol problem. And you start looking at Matt as Matt. And guess what? There are people in my zip code that fit that profile that I can connect with now to get help, right? I can't help somebody. The only thing in common I have with an alcoholic who went to war, unfortunately, you know, saw death, had PTSD, been incarcerated. The only thing I have in common with that individual is alcohol. So I can't empathize with all the other social determinants. I mean, I'm sorry about that, but guess what? There's lots of people in this community, in this world, city that do fit that profile that have figured out a way to build an extraordinary life. So my whole model with this was to try to connect people on a much deeper level than just what they're addicted to, and then start the healing process, right? And what the healing process in the app is that, you know, you can track the things that you're doing throughout the day to stay sober. So like after this podcast, I get to say, I made a new friend, right? I shared my story, right? So that's making me feel good, right? Later today, I'll do my workout, right? I'll select exercise, right? It's telling me the things that I'm doing. And now it's also showing the community, the way the user experiences, the community can see what I'm doing. The other piece is selflessness. What am I going to do today to be selfless? So again, sharing my story would be selfless. You know, coaching later would be selfless. And so it's getting people away from I'm an addict and nobody's like me, no one understands me, to know there are people all around you. It's just hard to find them, you know? And that's the challenge. When I got out of treatment, I won't belabor on this, but I was given literally a card with somebody's name on it. And he said, you know, she's like, here you go, call him. He's an alumni of the program. I said, is he sober? She's like, I hope. I said, well, what does he do for a living? Is he a surfer? Can I go back to San Diego and like go paddle out and catch waves and talk about his experience of recovery? And you know, she says to me, she's like, those would be really good things to know, wouldn't they? I was like, what?
yeah, right.
A whole load of money on a top rehab in this country. And I'm like, wait a minute, what is happening here? And so that's what it was. I just came back and I said, I'm not charging for it. I'm not commercializing it. It's free. I pay for it myself. And there's people all over the world engaging on it. And the story is that fills me up. I mean, I've got a 72-year-old that got sober. He's 4 years now sober, went back to grad school, exercising every day, back with his wife. I've got a rock and roller who was basically on his deathbed. His wife actually downloaded the app for him and made him get on. And he went back and got his master's degree. He's a better rock and roll player. He teaches kids now. He's got his wife back. I mean, so again, those stories drives the energy. You can see it in my voice, you know, hear my voice and see it in my face of success. Now, for every one of those success stories, statistics are still against all of us. You know, and that's another reason to have this virtual 24/7 community is that if you start to feel the urge or triggered or something bad happens, you don't have to go wait for an AA meeting or something like that to open up, right? There's somebody there ready to listen. You know, just we have like an SOS triggered button. Boom, click it. Somebody's going to say, hey, what's on? Video chat. Jump on the video chat. Let's go. Let's talk about it. What happened? Oh, you lost your job? Okay, let's work through that, right? And so it's also that support network of community, of like-minded individuals, that you know, the tribes, right? And I think creating these tribes of people that are all looking for the same thing, the common goal of recovery, and then working together to achieve it. And you know, in this virtual age now, it's scary. I mean, I soon to be 9-year-old last night, we're sitting in the hot tub and he's telling me about, you know, this one video game on his headset, whatever, one of those Oculuses. And he's like talking about the next generation. He's like, you know, Dad, I mean, at some point, like it's going to be, you know, we won't even have to go anywhere. Like if we want to go experience like another country, we can just put a headset on and they're going to have like all these. And I'm like, Jax, I want to go fly and experience the other country, dude. Like, I don't want to go fly fishing on a virtual river. I want to take you to Montana and go fly fishing, bro. I want you to smell the, and he's looking at me like, what? I'm like, so think about like this world and technology is creating natural disconnection at a rapid rate. So, and for people suffering from addiction, that's terrible, right? Disconnection is terrible. So I'm trying to combat that with connection and connectivity, right? But still realizing that, hey, you know, some of these technologies are great, right? The fact that I can Zoom through the app and, you know, in a moment's notice with a group of like-minded addicts is awesome, right? Couldn't do that 10 years, 15 years ago. So we leverage it when we can.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously very inspirational. I think that's making, you know, the selflessness piece and the wanting to make a difference piece, I think that also really resonates with me behind the driving forces of entrepreneurship and wanting to do something that you feel is actually making a difference. And so I think obviously at the end of the day, you know, you need to make a living, you need to be able to support yourself, but something like this where you know, you wanted it to be free, you didn't want to monetize it, it obviously fits in, I feel like, very naturally with what it is designed to be. And having that community, like you shared, if someone is, you know, has a trigger, they feel like they might fall back into it, to have someone that they can quickly go to and have a resource for them, because maybe they can't rely on a friend or a family member or something. I mean, you don't know where everybody's at. So yeah, I just really think that's a really cool app. I'll obviously tag that in the show notes so anybody can go check that out. And yeah, and Matt, you know, as we switch gears a little bit now too to talk about what you're doing at MedEvolve, and really there's probably a fair amount of people listening that are involved in healthcare. Are you able to just briefly provide like an overview of the healthcare revenue cycle, maybe for providers and how it could impact the, you know, the financial health of either a private practice or something like a hospital?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you think about the revenue cycle, right, it all starts at, I call it intake, right? So in some, you know, if it's a non-emergent, it's a scheduled visit, right? I call my doctor, I need to get an appointment. Okay, come in on Wednesday. Emergency case, you know, come into the ER, I've got a problem, right? So the start is there. Now, there's lots and lots of people, clinical and administrative, that are now getting involved with the hopes of delivering good care and ultimately getting paid for that care. And therein lies the issue, okay, is that there has been and will continue to be massive misalignment between what it truly costs to deliver quality care and what you get paid for it by the insurance company. And the other factor too that people need to understand is half this dollar comes from consumers now, right? I mean, I've got a $3,000-$4,000 deductible, right? So nobody's really paying for anything until I achieve that. Now the question is, can I afford that? Right? That's a lot. 20 years ago, that wasn't the issue. So you start to think about revenue cycle where we come from at MedEvolve is in the concept of touches. And I'm going to focus on the administrative side, right? We don't get involved in the clinical care side. But how many touches and by how many people does it take to get the outcome you expect, right? And this is something that the financial systems can't measure, right? They might be measuring some of the touches, but not all of the touches. And what's important about touch is that each touch now costs money. In fact, with inflation and wage inflation, it's costing you even more money, right? You used to pay $15 an hour. Now people are getting $20, $22, $23 an hour. So that's not going to change. So the cost of delivering care, right? The cost, the administrative costs and clinical costs is gone up naturally. Reimbursement for that care continues to go down, right? Medicare, Medicaid, cutting costs, right? You see it in pharmacy. Now let's get into the commercial managed care payers, right? They have quarterly profit margins of $1 billion+, but guess what? They're denying claims. They're using AI bots to deny claims. No, Eric, I'm not going to pay you for treating my patient. And here's why. And I hope your administrative team doesn't figure that out. And I can just, you know, you have to write it off. And so you have high cost, what I'm charging insurance, and then what I hope to get back. And that's a terrible business model. Okay. Because unfortunately, these profit margins now, today, especially in the last year with inflation and accelerated decline in reimbursement, are getting crushed. They're literally getting compressed to the point where we're now, what do you do, right? And so you're seeing the hospitals going out of business. You're seeing physician groups getting sucked up by hospitals. Physicians were selling off to private equity a lot, you know, the last few years. Now private equity's holding the bag, right? I mean, I got lots of private equity firms that were enjoying buying practices, flipping them for another big multiple, you know, a year later. Now they're like, I can't get rid of this practice because their financials are terrible. I'm like, yeah, I told you so. So revenue cycle, it has always been challenged, even in 2000 when I started my career. But today, there's macroeconomic conditions that are going on. They're going to turn this into a complete tragedy. And unfortunately, the people that suffer as a result of that is every single one of us, because we're all consumers of healthcare. And we see it every day. I mean, I just had a first-hand experience with my dad. You know, you talk about inefficiency. I mean, here's a guy who's had multiple hospitalizations, multiple 911, multiple reasons to end up in an ER and admitted to inpatient. Just had a procedure done last week. They discharge planner was going to discharge him back to the nursing home. Well, there's no clinical care in this place that he's at on the weekends. So you're going to send a guy home who has a history of messing with whatever it is they've done, which drives infection, which drives a 911 call, which drives a $3,000 ambulance ride, which drives an ER admission to inpatient. That insurance company is going to pay 10 grand versus what? $400 a night to send him to a skilled nursing facility for 3 days? If that's not misalignment, like to guys like you and me, I'm like, well, that's a terrible business model. It is. And who's driving that care? Not the provider. It's the insurance company, right? He had to stay 3 days. They require a 3-day inpatient stay before they will pay for you to go to a SNF. And he only had one night. So that's kind of an example. And so where's the other problem? And this is where I get confrontational a bit. Our administrators of these practices are not doing anyone any favors, right? They're living in the Stone Age, right? They're just trying to not get fired, right? They're out there, you know, making poor decisions for these revenue cycles and don't even realize it. And the people that are actually, in a sense, like almost getting stolen from is the providers. Do you know how many times I go into a provider group, large or small, and I ask them, I say, okay, what's your net collection rate? And they look at me and they go, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you bill a dollar and your contract says 97 cents. Are you getting 97? And they're like, I don't know. I said, well, you know, it's costing you 20% more now in labor to still bill the same dollar that you were even a year and a half ago. And you're getting less reimbursement. You don't know the answer to that. And then you go to the administrators and I'm like, do you know the answer to that? No. And if they think they do, it's something they run like once a month. It's very manual. It's Excel pivot table. It's a joke. It's a complete joke. So if that doesn't change, I don't know how to help this industry, right? And you know, the software that we've developed, it gives you this insight in real time. I mean, there's no question. It's like, here's your problem. Here's the three things to do about it. But whether someone wants to buy that and invest the time and energy to deploy it, that's still a problem in this industry. And until somebody is willing to force those things in, and it's not just our company, there's tons of companies doing amazing things with data and technology, but everyone has trouble selling to healthcare because you are selling sophisticated ideas while simple are being sold to an unsophisticated industry with an unsophisticated buyer. And I don't mean unsophisticated as dumb. A lot of these people are Harvard MBAs, you know, I mean, they're smart people, great medical schools. I mean, unsophisticated is that we keep making the same stupid mistakes and not doing anything different. That's the problem. And the difference today than 20 years ago, Eric, is that the margins are under such pressure with the macroeconomic conditions of today than they were 20 years ago. And that's where it's getting these doctors completely thrown off, because they don't understand why they're working five times harder for less money, right? And that trend is not going to change, right? At some point, you can only do this many surgeries. Our founder, who's an orthopedic surgeon, we joke about it. He said, I got to do five times the surgeries today than I did 20 years ago to make less money. And I'm like, well Bill, how many more can you get on the docket today? Yeah, you do a couple more hips, maybe skip lunch, do another knee. Think about it. It's like at some point you run out of capacity. Like I can't do anymore.
Right.
So, but yeah. Nobody's addressing it. It's the human. And I'm telling you right now, the human condition problem, and we kind of to bring it back around to this concept of obsession, self-actualization. I want to be the best at what I do. I want to be proud of what I do. That's like gone, right? So you have this whole workforce now that wants to be recognized. They want to be rewarded, but they don't really want to work, right? Very few do. And so one of the things we do at MedEvolve is we actually gamify our revenue cycle software in that people who are really achieving actually get rewarded, economically rewarded for that. And they get celebrated, right, publicly, you know, and that's been a big win for us is that, hey, I mean, if you want to be here and you want to step up and do the best you can, well, you're going to get more money, right, more PTO, more merch, whatever, you know, however we gamify it. And you're going to get recognized for it, right? And that kind of plays into this new need of how many likes do I have? How many listeners do I have? How many, you know, I mean, it's this whole world now where we kind of operate on the social media concept of recognition and reward systems. And we've seen a lot of success even in the earlier days of trying this out. So that's really where our company is focused is understanding, you know, where humans keep getting involved in revenue cycle. And we do that by measuring every touch. And then we start to diagnose quickly through our analytics stack is why? Why do these humans still? What mistakes are being made? How do we need to improve people, process, and ideally technology and alignment between the three to improve? I call it the no human had to get involved rate. Right now, I can tell you across all of our clients, I had my best client still has humans getting involved and about 35% of the claims that go out the door. And my average client, it's like less than 50%. It's like 50%. That's a lot of humans at 20 to 22 bucks an hour that are getting involved and trying to get you paid for the services you guys as clinicians are delivering.
Right. And during that time, you made me think of, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. So it's kind of like we're there with the healthcare revenue cycle and it's obviously not improving in terms of the costs are increasing and the reimbursement is decreasing. So it's like you're kind of going to a bottleneck of, do you think at some point, Matt, we might reach a point where like it's just going to collapse? I mean, I guess how close might we be to that? Or is that something that you feel like would just not happen? I guess I'm trying to figure out not a doomsday proposition, but just how close are we to something like that maybe occurring?
I mean, I think we're closer than we realize. You know, I think that the again, this is my opinion, you know, but I think that this country is never going to, at least in my lifetime, is going to adopt a single payer system, right? You know, because that would be a natural single payer, understand the cost, you know, get rid of commercial managed care, right? People want to pay for extra insurance, they can. But at the end of the day, right, that would be a step in the right direction. But are you willing to pay 50, 60% of your income tax so that everybody can have that, right? And I live in a state where I'm already getting taxed out the wazoo here in California. And so, you know, that's a harder model. I think that what scares me more is it's the payment models are also changing, right? And so where it used to be, you know, I deliver a service, I bill the insurance pays me per contract. Now you're getting all the value-based care, right? So it's like, well, I'm going to pay you if you achieve these metrics. And so what's happening now is that, and again, those haven't really like taken off the way that people assume they would over the last 15 years, but it's coming, right? Where there's going to be more pay for performance initiatives, especially in the commercial managed care and Medicare, Medicaid, is to hold the providers more accountable for the quality outcomes. That takes a lot of time and a lot of money to deliver. And there's still no guarantee you're going to get paid, right? So all of this game, right? You walk into a grocery store and you load up your cart and you put it on the belt. You just get told at checkout, like it's $100. And you're like, great, here's my $100, right? Healthcare, you get up there, you're told it's $100, but then the payer's only going to pay you, I'll give you 60 today. I need you to write 40 of that off to bad debt. I don't have the money to pay the extra 40. What other business would do that, right?
And none, zero.
So when reimbursement keeps being so fickle, like patterns and models and stuff, the thing that's fixed is the cost of delivering the care and the administrative burden of billing for it and getting paid for it, right? That's relatively fixed and inefficient still, right? But on the reimbursement side, it's not. I think the other big thing is the true cost of delivering care, right? You're a pharmacist. I mean, do you think McKesson is getting crushed? No. Those profit margins for those drug companies, those profit margins for those supply chain companies, those profit margins for the insurance companies are doing great. Who's not doing great? The healthcare providers who have their bond ratings being dropped, who can't get good loans, who are relying on federal subsidies, you know, or state subsidies to stay afloat, right? And then let's talk about one last thing, which is, well, I'm just not going to treat those types of patients. I mean, okay, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I'm like, I'm done with Medicare and I never treated Medicaid. And frankly, I'm only going to treat either cash pay or Blue Cross Blue Shield because I have a good relationship. So now we're limiting, we're limiting society. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, I have this issue that I need solved because it's causing pain in my life, but I can't find anyone who's going to take me.
I mean, yeah, it's like, horrible.
I mean, look at rehab. Let's talk about rehab. Good luck finding top-notch rehabs, you know, that are going to take your insurance, right? You're coming out of pocket, man. And if you don't have the means or the family doesn't have the means, then what? Are you out of luck? Possibly. It's such a funny, I see revenue cycles today that have so much opportunity to drive improvement. But the decisions that keep getting made by the administrators and the lack of knowledge and understanding of the providers doesn't seem to be changing. It's really, that's the most alarming part. So to your question on where is this going, not a good place. You know, I mean, we know we're not going to go to a single payer. We know whoever the next president is or the president after that is not going to solve this problem. And yet the bigger problem is the misalignment between the payer, the provider, and the consumer. And I think the misalignment between the consumer and the payer and the provider and the payer are the widest, right? I think provider and consumer is getting better, right? You know, treating portals, better information, better understanding of what you're going to call, you know, pay for service. But it's that damn payer. It's that third party that's paying you, right? That's always been the trouble and is continuing to be the trouble. And that's a hard business to run when you don't really know if you're going to get paid or not.
Right. Yeah. That's, I saw that firsthand, you know, my experiences coming through school, working with a lot of independent pharmacy owners, back in Oklahoma. And really, yeah, I mean, you see that and it's kind of, that's what got me thinking from the entrepreneurial standpoint of like, there probably is a better business model for this. And that's what kind of led me to not necessarily want to own an independent pharmacy, because you can't really run it like a business. I think the grocery store example is a perfect example of that, with, you know, the payment. Like, where could you possibly go to buy, you know, athletic equipment to do track, and just say, you know, I'll give you $250 of the $500 tab today. And it's like, who's going to take that? No one's going to do that. Unless there's some type of contract built out or something,
But even still, like, you think about now, half this money comes from us, right? With these high deductible plans, right? And so for me, it's like, I could say, look, I can give you $250 today, but I'm going to have to pay the next $250 out over 24 months, because I may lose my job, or my heating bill just went up 20%, or my gas bill, or my water bill, or kids' education, right? My property, my taxes, right? And so the consumer who's still getting stuck with a large part of the bill is also going to have more flexibility in how they pay for their services, which is further crushing, call it the grocery store, right? I mean, you know, or the sports store, right? It's talking to you. Every time I talk about this, and I talk all the time about it, especially at shows, I either laugh out loud, or I'm definitely laughing in my head, because I don't consider myself, like, I consider myself a very disciplined, driven guy. But I wouldn't consider myself like that smart. I'm sitting here going like, this is the most practical problem that I can see. Why am I still having these conversations more than two decades into my career?
It's a valid question.
It's crazy, right? It's like, right, same freaking problem. That's why consulting firms, by the way, the best place to be is a consultant, because these guys are crushing it. They're going to go into these healthcare systems and these provider groups. They're going to sit there and do the same assessment. They're going to do the design recommendations, and they're going to leave. And that provider group is probably going to do absolutely nothing with the insights. And if they did implement something, they'll have enough turnover in their leadership team and their management team and their staff team over 12 months that it's all going to fall apart. And guess what? That firm comes right back in. So it's like that
recurrence.
Place. Being a vendor, like, trying to be a tech vendor in healthcare is sucks, right? But being a consultant, like, I'm like, worst case scenario, I'll just go back into consulting. I'll tell you exactly what you need to do, and you probably won't do anything about it. And a year later, I'll come back in and say, well, why didn't you do it? And we had blah, blah, blah. Sorry, well, let's talk about it again. Problem's worse, still the same solution.
Yes, it is. Right. I can see the either laughing out loud or laughing in your head happening if you talk about it enough. It is to me. I mean, it's not amusing, but it is funny to talk with someone about this. But yeah, Matt, I really appreciate you coming onto the podcast. If someone is listening and wants to reach out to you and learn more or connect with you, what is the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like LinkedIn's probably the best. So if you want to just drop my LinkedIn profile on it, you know, hit me up on LinkedIn. I love, you know, having conversations both on, you know, obviously the healthcare side or the entrepreneurial side or the addiction side. You know, I love all of those conversations. And so anything I do that to further help your listeners would be fine with me.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, Matt Seifeld, again, can't thank you enough for appearing on the Eric Mueller Show. We'll tag everything in the show notes, including the My LifeLink app as well, which is that sobriety community app. We'll look forward to following you and keeping up with you. And I really wish you the best of luck with everything.
Yeah. Thanks, Eric. I really appreciate the time and effort put into this. So you have a great show.
Oh, thank you, man. That means a lot. Take care.